We're going to start talking about the fraudulent inducement cases first. And before we get into the specifics of, and I know a lot of you, I know everyone is probably well familiar with these, but we want to put those in context with, you know, the history of you know, where these new cases came from: Orca Assets, Lufkin, Barrow Shaver, Mercedes-Benz. You know, it used to be that there was this general concept that I as an injured, a complaining injured party, it is not my responsibility to make sure that you don't defraud me. So the old language, when I came out of law school 20 years ago, under Schlumberger and the case, which was brand new back then, was this notion that, sure, that fraudulent inducement is bad, fraud is bad. We can't shift responsibility for fraudulent conduct onto the injured party who didn't do their due diligence. And that sort of percolated, I think, through, you know, defensively through a lot of those cases. I think that's where we're seeing the biggest shift. I mean, Schlumberger was a disclaimer of reliance that the court enforced, and there were two main aspects of it, one of which I think is pretty much gone or largely abrogated, and the other of which is very much alive. The first from Schlumberger is the fact that that was a the fraudulent inducement claim arose out of the context of a settlement agreement. And so the court was really focused on this notion that there was an ongoing fight, there was an ongoing battle, and it has to end somewhere. And there was a disclaimer of reliance. The parties entered into it. We're going to enforce this settlement agreement. And for years, there was a tendency to try and distinguish cases coming up through the courts on that basis. You know, taking the position that, wait a minute, this isn't a settlement agreement. This is a totally new deal. You know, this is an arm's length transaction. The parties didn't have that kind of history. That kind of distinguishing factor, for the most part, really is no longer a viable way of approaching a defense of a fraudulent inducement claim. Where we are seeing it, and we'll see it in Orca Assets and the other cases we're talking about, is that the courts and the Texas Supreme Court's recent decisions are focusing quite specifically on what happens before the contract is induced. What are the parties talking about? What do they care about? We'll hear about this when we talk about red flags. I mean, you can't have a red flag without it being relevant to something happening between the parties. So in that sense, these cases are still sort of resolving, let's say they're resolving negotiations as opposed to an ongoing dispute. So in that sense, the analysis is the same, but fraudulent inducement, disclaimer of reliance provisions, no longer just in the realm of settlement agreements. What is still very much alive, and I think we're going to see a lot of development in this area in fraudulent inducement cases, is the sophistication of the parties. And that ties into the court's contract analysis in a variety of different areas. The notion that sophisticated parties, particularly when they're represented by counsel, they're sort of presumed to know what they're doing, and they're going to be held to their bargain. They're going to be held to their contract. It is not the job of the courts to get you out of a bad deal. It is not the job of the courts to save you if you weren't paying attention when you signed a contract that didn't do what you were hoping it was going to do. There's a lot of focus on this language about sophisticated parties, and it's very much alive in the court's analysis. What I don't think we've seen quite yet, and I'm going to transfer here to Orca Assets. I'm going to ask Nicole about it here in a second. But what we're looking for is how those are playing out in the trial courts and the courts of appeals. What happens when there is a significant disparity in position and sophistication and representation among the parties? Is that going to make a difference? How forcefully is the sanctity of contract policy that the court is really focused on, how much is that going to apply? So far, the big cases that we've seen, you know, all of these cases, a lot of them are oil and gas cases among sophisticated players. that's really not an issue. So I don't think we've seen the court have to really detail when the disparity in sophistication or a non-sophisticated party changes this analysis so much that we're not looking in the same sort of, you know, bucket of tests that we're seeing coming out of these cases. With that very big and probably way too drawn out introduction, Nicole, why don't you give us the we have a very sophisticated audience. Yeah. We don't need to spend too much time on an introduction for Orca Assets, but what are the key takeaways and the tests that we care about and the analysis coming out of Orca Assets that we care about?
Sure. Thanks, Kendall. And I think because the Orca Assets was so fact-based, we can touch on some of the facts while we, even though we'll skip straight to the test. So in Orca Assets, this is an oil and gas case regarding the sale of, regarding leasing tracts in the Eagle Ford Shale. The court said that there are two prongs to consider when you're looking at a negation of warranty clause or a disclaimer of reliance. First, we look at a comprehensive red flags analysis, and that'll be very fact specific. And then we look at whether there is a direct conflict between the contract language and the representations that were made that were false. That one will be much more focused on what the specific contract language is. So in Orca Assets, there were a lot of red flags that the court considered. The